This series contains adult language and depictions of graphic violence. Listener discretion is advised. The summer of 1871 was an exceptionally hot one in Chicago. Drought conditions and strong, steady winds from the southwest made for a particularly dangerous combination with regard to fire danger. Also of note, more than two-thirds of all buildings in the city of Chicago were made of wood. Dry, brittle wood that hadn't felt rain in months. By the time autumn rolled around, things hadn't gotten much better. Temperatures had dropped, as could be expected, but still, no rain. Then, at about 8:30 on the evening of October 8th, legend tells us that a cow, owned by the O'Leary family, was eating some hay in a barn just south of the city center when something spooked her. The cow then inadvertently knocked over a lantern, igniting the dry hay, which spread to the shed next to the barn. That shed was the first structure to be burned in the Great Chicago Fire. Over the next 3 days, the fire would jump the south branch of the Chicago River and destroy a significant amount of central Chicago. Then the fire would cross the main stem of the river and ravage the north side of the city. Along with the majority of the structures being constructed of wood, so were the sidewalks and many of the actual roads. The city, now an explosive hellscape, burned for 3 days, claimed the lives of more than 300 people, and consumed 17,000 separate structures. The path of destruction was nearly a mile wide, 4 miles long, and covered 2,000 total acres. 73 miles of road, 120 miles of sidewalks, 2,000 lampposts. The city was reduced to ash. More than one-third of the assessed total value of Chicago was wiped out. But from that smoldering rubble rose a truly magnificent second city with vastly improved building codes, a modern layout, and a complete ban of wooden structures in the city center. If you visit Chicago today, you'll be amazed at the marble and stone buildings that predate the steel skyscrapers as a result of the improved construction demands. If you were a citizen of Chicago in the fall of 1871, amidst all of the destruction in the aftermath of the conflagration, there's no way that you would have believed if someone told you that a mere 22 years later, your city would play host to the world in an era-defining six-month celebration that would see citizens from near and far descend on Chicago to celebrate as one at the World's Columbian Exposition, also known as the Chicago World's Fair. The Columbian Exposition was imagined as a celebration marking the 400th anniversary of the Christopher Columbus expedition that landed Europeans in the New World for the first time. It was conceived as a way of joining American and European industry, art, technology, and culture from 47 participating nations over the course of the six-month run. The city commissioned 14 brand new buildings in the neoclassical style to be built around a massive reflecting pool. The grandest of these buildings was the magnificent administration building designed by architect Richard Morris Hunt. The reflecting pool, officially called the Grand Basin, was meant to represent the great ocean Columbus navigated and contained exact replicas of his ships. There was also a recreation of the Grand Canal in Venice, Italy, complete with gondolas. There were several technological and engineering firsts at the Chicago World's Fair. The first moving walkway, which patrons could use as they traveled the banks of the Grand Basin en route to the casino. Sure, we see them in airports all the time, but this was the first one ever, and it was at this fair in 1893. The electric car made its debut, along with the dishwasher, peanut butter, brownies, the first national performance by Harry Houdini. But the most popular attraction at the fair was, hands down, the creation of a 24-year-old engineer by the name of George Washington Gale Ferris Jr. He kept his invention a secret as long as he could, but when it was first unveiled, most people were too scared to even give it a try. You see, George Ferris Jr. constructed and operated the world's first Ferris wheel at the Columbian Exposition in 1893. People's fears were soon allayed as Ferris himself took several trips on his invention to prove it was safe. And soon, the line stretched almost a mile. People couldn't get enough of the thrill of getting such a wonderful view of not only the fairgrounds, but the entire city of Chicago, Lake Michigan. It seemed like they could see forever. Beyond the engineering breakthroughs and foods introduced for the first time, there was one other first that used the Chicago World's Fair for its national debut. America's first serial killer. Welcome back to The Devil Within. You're listening to Homegrown Horror. Okay, so this is going to be a 2 or 3 part miniseries. I was thinking of tackling this case as a separate season of The Devil Within, but it kind of falls in between a one-off and a full-blown series. So, our first miniseries. Hope you like it. Here we go. The town of Gilmanton, New Hampshire, was first founded way back in 1727. At the time, it was the second largest city in the state after Portsmouth. But then, well, then nothing really happened. In the census of 1800, the town had a population of 3,752 people. 210 years later, in the census of 2010, the town had a population of 3,777 people. The town has a similar history to other pre-revolutionary New England towns. Land grants were awarded, farms were established, roads were built, etc. In this case, most of the land grants, 24 in total, went to one family, the Gilmans. The original name of the town was actually Gilmantown, before it became either colloquially or by decision, Gilmanton. Maybe it's Gilmanton. Let's go with Gilmanton. That makes more sense. But it's easy to see the evolution of the name. Gilmanton. Okay. A theological seminary was established along with Gilmanton Academy by the mid-1700s, and an adjacent plot of land was developed for a separate community built around a blast furnace and smelting operation. This town was envisioned as being a massive producer of iron, which would make everyone rich. The town was incorporated originally as Averytown, but would later be renamed Gilmanton Iron Works. The town and the iron works was a failure, as the local iron mines didn't produce on a consistent basis, and the business quickly went elsewhere in the industrial explosion that swept across the Northeast. So Gilmanton became a place you leave to go find your fortune in the big city, and then maybe you return to retire to the quiet life, maybe raise a family of your own. That would account for the stunningly consistent population numbers over the last 230 years. Yes, of course, there were years of exodus that saw upwards of 30% of the population leave the town. The Civil War years in particular caused a massive reduction in the population of Gilmanton, especially young men of fighting age. But there were also periods of tremendous influx of residents. In season 3 of The Devil Within, we discussed the reasons behind New York City losing fully 10% of its population in the decade spanning 1970 to 1980. Well, those people had to go somewhere. It seems that more than 900 of them landed in Gilmanton, leading to a 92% population increase in that same time period. It always seems to even out in Gilmanton. But there was one particular citizen whose departure would prove to be a boon for the small community. Because if he had stayed, he may very well have killed every last one of them. It was sometime in the late 1880s, during one of those periods of exodus in Gilmanton, that a young man, an aspiring doctor of exceptional intelligence, said his goodbyes, and made his way west. This was 21-year-old Herman Webster Mudgett. Herman Mudgett was born in the spring of 1861, the third child of Levi Mudgett and his wife Theodate Price. As most all families were back then, Herman was raised in a strict religious household. This one happened to be Methodist. And his father was a wealthy man, working alternately as a farmer and a trader. The family did so well, in fact, that Mr. Mudgett was able to send his son Herman to the prestigious Exeter Academy as an adolescent, and then nearby Gilmanton Academy for high school. There are reports that, while an excellent provider, Mr. Mudgett was an abusive father who drank heavily and mistreated everyone in his family. Often, an abused child at home could at least expect an escape from torment while at school, but this, unfortunately, wasn't the case for young Herman. He was viciously bullied at school, mainly due to his tremendous academic achievements, which seemed never-ending. Top marks among all students, regardless of age or subject, every year at any school he happened to be enrolled in. But, as is so often the case, signs of trouble appeared early. There was one particular reported incident which, if true, is very telling in the development of Herman Mudgett. Allegedly, a group of bullies realized that young Herman was kind of creeped out by the human skeleton on display in their biology classroom. So, as bullies do, they decided to exploit that fear for their own amusement. They forced Herman to stand directly in front of the skeleton and place the skeleton's hands on his own face. Sensing his abject fear, the bullies got what they wanted and retreated. But Herman remained. Yes, terrified at first, but then oddly at peace, being that intimately connected with death. He would later admit that the encounter helped him overcome his anxieties and led to an obsession with death, an obsession he would seek to satisfy for the remainder of his life.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
It all began soon after the skeleton incident. Surgical experiments on dead animals, dissections. But that soon proved to not be enough to satisfy the boy. He figured out how to trap animals and perform his grisly experiments on live subjects. These activities would supposedly continue throughout his time at the University of Vermont, where he enrolled in 1879. It was then that Herman Mudgett would leave Gilmanton forever. But not before he took a wife, a local girl named Clara Lovering. His time in Vermont would last barely a year before he transferred to the University of Michigan Department of Medicine and Surgery. While attending classes, Herman realized he would also need a job to support his wife and newborn son. He would earn a living working in the anatomy lab under the guidance of Professor William Herdman, and it was here that Mudgett's other talents were discovered. Theft, fraud, and a million other forms of grift. The first was grave robbing, simply to supply the university with fresh cadavers for educational purposes. Yes, the school would pay for the cadavers, but not as much as could be made using the corpses in other nefarious schemes, namely, insurance fraud. Claiming a life insurance policy as the surviving family member of a recently deceased person was very lucrative. The only problem was the actual person in whose name the policy was written was still very much alive. But back then, if you could produce a body, a fake marriage certificate, and wouldn't you know it, they also had a death certificate signed off by a doctor, well, the scam proved to be foolproof. As long as the real person remained alive. If, on the off chance, the actual insured person happened to pass away, and a grieving family member filed for the claim to be paid out, well, that would prove troublesome for Herman Mudgett. But these scams allowed Herman to build up a substantial nest egg for him to establish himself after graduation. So in 1886, Herman Mudgett moved to Chicago to begin his life as a doctor. He decided he needed two things. He needed a job in the medical field to position himself in the market, and he needed to completely abandon his wife and son. Although at the time it must have been difficult and painful for them, I'm sure in the long run, they were grateful to be away from the monster that Herman would become. So remember, he was set for money. He just needed to get his foot in the door of the Chicago medical community. Not long after arriving in town, Herman happened upon a drugstore at the corner of 63rd Street and Wallace Avenue. The drugstore was owned by a woman named Elizabeth Holton, and she just so happened to be in need of a pharmacist's apprentice. This bright young man, recently graduated from the University of Michigan, well, he certainly seemed to know medicine, and he was eager to start right away. He applied for the open position as Henry Howard Holmes, the name he would go by for the rest of his life. He claimed he chose the name due to his love of the literary character Sherlock Holmes, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's enduring masterpiece of a creation, and would quickly abbreviate the name to the more professional-sounding H.H. Holmes. And that's the name the world would eventually know him by. Dr. Holmes proved to be a hard worker and a trusted employee, and, well, things seemed to be going very well for the young man. He even married again, a woman named Myrta Belknap. And soon after the wedding, his boss, Miss Holton, decided it was time for her to retire, and she wanted to sell the drugstore. And guess who had enough money socked away to buy the business and the building outright? Yep, Dr. H.H. Holmes. And not only did he have the money to buy the drugstore from his old boss, he also purchased the lot directly across the street to build a mixed-use two-story structure with businesses in the ground floor, including a new pharmacy, and residential apartments on the second floor. By 1888, the building was completed, and Dr. Holmes was again showing his true colors. He failed to pay both the architect as well as the steel supplier and was sued for damages. By January of 1890, hundreds of miles to the east, the United States House of Representatives was busy voting on a measure that would award the upcoming Columbian Exposition, the massive six-month World's Fair discussed earlier, to the most deserving city, which meant the city that could best afford to do it properly. There were major contenders, but it came down to New York and Chicago. Both cities had wealthy patrons that offered to more than finance all the construction, the buying of land, importing of goods, labor costs, everything. It seemed destined to land in the Big Apple. But after the first vote, Chicago had a commanding lead. Not quite enough for the majority, but it was looking good. So Chicago had just as much, if not more, money pledged to cover the financing, but New York had... it had New York. They thought the reputation of the city would be enough, but that actually worked against them. The location of the city was the problem. The Northeast. If this fair was truly going to bring Americans from all corners of the country, shouldn't it be more centrally located? More easily accessible to denizens of the West? That was the argument. And wasn't that what the organizers were literally banking on? It was. Plus, there was much more vacant land available in the Chicago metro area, land that wouldn't require purchase or moving people out or, hell, even leveling it to make it suitable for building. The city of Chicago was at the time basically surrounded by vast plains as far as the eye could see. So if the money to create the fair was the same, why not pick the locale that gave the organizers the best chance to maximize their profits? Chicago won the bid for the fair on the 8th ballot, and word spread like wildfire. Sorry, bad analogy for a Chicago story. Word spread quickly. The announcement that Chicago would be hosting the World's Fair in 1893 started what amounted to a Midwestern gold rush. People from all over the world set their sights on the Windy City. Builders and designers, inventors, performers, laborers, grifters and scammers, and just about anybody else that wanted to be at the center of the action. Smart people in Chicago knew that all of these visitors would need a place to stay. And, seemingly overnight, hotels and tenements began to sprout like weeds. They had 3 years to prepare, and they would be more than ready to welcome the world. Meanwhile, at the corner of 63rd and Wallace, Dr. Holmes was enjoying his life as a landowner and pharmacist. But something was missing. That darkness in his center was still as vibrant and demanding as ever. He also knew that millions of visitors would soon descend upon his city, and he wanted his share. He made the decision to expand, upwards. He contracted with an architect who obviously wasn't aware of Holmes's reputation, and he had that company design a third floor to his building that would serve as a hotel for guests visiting the fair. He had time to get it built, get it furnished, and then add some major renovations that he would do entirely by himself. Why? Well, so no one would be able to figure out that what he was actually building would amount to a murder mansion. On the next episode of The Devil Within, the fair begins, and with it, the disappearances of several young, pretty women who traveled to Chicago on their own. And they all checked in to Dr. Holmes's Hotel of Horrors. That's next time on The Devil Within. The Devil Within is a Cloud 10 Media production, recorded live at Bel Air Studios in Los Angeles, California. Written and produced by Brandon Morgan. Executive produced by Sim Sarna. Our post-production supervisor is Bruce Witkin, who also provided original music for this episode. For The Devil Within, I'm your host, Brandon Morgan.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.